Tyrion. He dreamt of his lord father and the shrouded lord. He dreamt that they were one and the same. And when his father wrapped stone arms around him and bent to give him his grey kiss, he woke with his mouth dry and rusty, with a taste of blood and his heart hammering in his chest. "Our dead dwarf has returned to us," Holden said. Tyrion shook his head to clear away the webs of dream. "The sorrows. I was lost in the sorrows. I am not dead." "That remains to be seen." The half-maester stood over him. "Duck, be a fine fowl and boil some broth for our little friend here. He must be famished." He was on the shy maid, Tyrion saw, under a scratchy blanket that smelled of vinegar. "The sorrows are behind us. It was just a dream I dreamed as I was drowning. Why do I stink of vinegar?" "L'Amour has been washing you with it. Some say it helps prevent the grayscale. I'm inclined to doubt that, but there's no harm in trying. It was L'Amour who forced the water from your lungs after Griff had pulled you up. You were as cold as ice, and your lips were blue. Yandri said we ought to throw you back, but the lad forbade it." The prince! Memory came rushing back. The stone man reaching out with cracked grey hands, the blood seeping from his knuckles. "He was heavy as a boulder, pulling me under. Griff brought me up. He must hate me, or he would have let me die. How long have I been sleeping? What place is this?" "Sel Horis." Holden produced a small knife from his sleeve. "Here," he said, tossing it underhand at Tyrion. The dwarf flinched. The knife landed between his feet and stood quivering in the deck. He plucked it out. "What's this?" "Take off your boots. Prick each of your toes and fingers." "That sounds painful." "I hope so. Do it." Tyrion yanked off one boot, then the other, peeled down his hose, squinted at his toes. It seemed to him they looked no better or worse than usual. He poked gingerly at one big toe. "Harder," urged Holden Halfmaester. "Do you want me to draw blood?" "If need be, I'll have a scab on every toe. The purpose of the exercise is not to count your toes. I want to see you wince. So long as the pricks hurt, you are safe. It is only when you cannot feel the blade that you will have cause to fear." "Grey scale," Tyrion grimaced. He stabbed another toe, cursed as a bead of blood welled up around the knife's point. "That hurt? Are you happy?"
"Dancing with joy."
"Your feet smell worse than mine, Yellow." Duck had a cup of broth. "Griff warned you not to lay hands upon the stone men."
"Aye, but he forgot to warn the stone men not to lay their hands upon me."
"As you prick, look for patches of dead grey skin, for nails beginning to turn black," said Holden. "If you see such signs, do not hesitate. Better to lose a toe than a foot. Better to lose an arm than spend your days wailing on the bridge of dream. Now the other foot, if you please. Then your fingers." The dwarf recrossed his stunted legs and began to prick the other set of toes. "Shall I prick my prick as well?"
"It would not hurt."
"It would not hurt you, is what you mean. Though I had as well slice it off, for all the use I make of it. Feel free. We will have it tanned and stuffed and sell it for a fortune. A dwarf's cock has magical powers. I've been telling all the women that for years." Tyrion drove the dagger's point into the ball of his thumb, watched the blood bead up, sucked it away. "How long must I continue to torture myself? When will we be certain that I'm clean?"
"Truly," said the half-maester, "never. You swallowed half the river. You may be going grey even now, turning to stone from inside out, starting with your heart and lungs. If so, pricking your toes and bathing in vinegar will not save you. When you've done, come have some broth." The broth was good, though Tyrion noted that the half-maester kept the table between them as he ate. The shy maid was moored to a weathered pier on the east bank of the Rhône. Two piers down, a Volantine river galley was discharging soldiers. Shops and stalls and storehouses huddled beneath a sandstone wall. The towers and domes of the city were visible beyond it, reddened by the light of the setting sun. "No, not a city." Selhoris was still accounted a mere town, and was ruled from old Volantis. This was not Westeros. L'Amour emerged on deck, with the prince in tow. When she saw Tyrion, she rushed across the deck to hug him.
"The mother is merciful! We have prayed for you, Hugo!"
"You did at least. I won't hold that against you." Young Griff's greeting was less effusive. The princeling was in a solemn mood, angry that he had been forced to remain on the Shy Maid instead of going ashore with Yandri and Ysilla.
"We only want to keep you safe," L'Amour told him. "These are unsettled times."
Holden Halfmaester explained. "On the way down from the Sorrows to Selhoris, we thrice glimpsed raiders moving south along the river's eastern shore, Dothraki. Once they were so close, we could hear their bells tinkling in their braids, and sometimes at night their fires could be seen beyond the eastern hills. We passed warships as well, Volantine river galleys, crammed with slave soldiers. The Triarchs fear an attack upon Selhoris plainly." Tyrion understood that quick enough. Alone amongst the major river towns, Selhoris stood upon the eastern bank of the Rhône, making it much more vulnerable to the Horse Lords than its sister towns across the river. "Even so, it is a small prize. If I were Carl, I would faint at Selhoris, let the Volantines rush to defend it, then swing south and ride hard for Volantis itself." "I know how to use a sword," young Griff was insisting. "Even the bravest of your forebears kept his king's guard close about him in times of peril." L'Amour had changed out of her scepter's robes into garbs more befitting the wife or daughter of a prosperous merchant. Tyrion watched her closely. He had sniffed out the truth beneath the dyed blue hair of Griff and young Griff easily enough, and Yandri and Ysilla seemed to be no more than they claimed to be, whilst Duck was somewhat less. L'Amour, though. "Who is she, really? Why is she here? Not for gold, I'll judge. What is this prince to her? Was she ever a true scepter?" Holden took note of her change of garb as well. "What are we to make of this sudden loss of faith? I preferred you in your scepter's robes, L'Amour."
"I preferred her naked," said Tyrion.
L'Amour gave him a reproachful look.
"That is because you have a wicked soul. Scepter's robes scream of Westeros, and might draw unwelcome eyes onto us."
She turned back to Prince Aegon.
"You are not the only one who must needs hide."
The lad did not seem appeased.
"The perfect prince, but still half a boy for all that, with little and less experience of the world and all its woes."
"Prince Aegon," said Tyrion, "since we are both stuck aboard this boat, perhaps you will honour me with a game of Saivas to while away the hours."
The prince gave him a wary look.
"I am sick of Saivas."
"Sick of losing to a dwarf, you mean?"
That pricked the lad's pride just as he'd known it would.
"Go fetch the board and pieces. This time I mean to smash you."
They played on deck, sitting cross-legged behind the cabin. Young Griff arrayed his army for attack, with dragon, elephants, and heavy horse up front. "A young man's formation, as bold as it is foolish. He risks all for the quick kill." He let the prince have first move. Holden stood behind them, watching the play. When the prince reached for his dragon, Tyrion cleared his throat.
I wouldn't do that if I were you. It is a mistake to bring your dragon out too soon.
He smiled innocently.
Your father knew the dangers of being overbold. Did you know my true father? Well, I saw him twice or thrice, but I was only 1 in 10 when Robert killed him, and mine own sire had me hidden underneath a rock. No, I cannot claim I knew Prince Rhaegar, not as your false father did. Lord Cunnington was the prince's dearest friend, was he not?
Young Griff pushed a lock of blue hair out of his eyes.
They were squires together at King's Landing.
A true friend, our Lord Cunnington. He must be, to remain so fiercely loyal to the grandson of the king, who took his lands and titles and sent him into exile. A pity about that. Elsewise, Prince Rhaegar's friend might have been on hand when my father sacked King's Landing to save Prince Rhaegar's precious little son from getting his royal brains dashed out against a wall.
The lad flushed.
That was not me, I told you. That was some tanner's son from Piswater Bend, whose mother died birthing him. His father sold him to Lord Varys for a jug of Arbor Gold. He had other sons, but had never tasted Arbor Gold. Varys gave the Piswater boy to my lady mother and carried me away.
Aye, Tyrion moved his elephants. And when the Piswater prince was safely dead, the eunuch smuggled you across the narrow sea to his fat friend, the cheesemonger, who hid you on a pole boat and found an exiled lord willing to call himself your father. It does make for a splendid story, and the singers will make much of your escape once you take the Iron Throne, assuming that our fair Daenerys takes you for a consort.
She will, she must.
Must? Tyrion made a tisking sound.
That is not a word queens like to hear. You are a perfect prince, agreed, bright and bold and comely as any maid could wish. Daenerys Targaryen is no maid, however. She is the widow of a Dothraki Khal, a mother of dragons and sacker of cities, Aegon the Conqueror with teats. She may not prove as willing as you wish.
She'll be willing, Prince Aegon sounded shocked. It was plain that he had never before considered the possibility that his bride-to-be might refuse him.
You don't know her. He picked up his heavy horse and put it down with a thump. The dwarf shrugged.
I know that she spent her childhood in exile, impoverished, living on dreams and schemes, running from one city to the next, always fearful, never safe, friendless but for a brother who was by all accounts half mad, a brother who sold her maidenhead to the Dothraki for the promise of an army. I know that somewhere out upon the grass her dragons hatched, and so did she. I know she is proud. How not? What else was left her but pride? I know she is strong. How not? The Dothraki despise weakness. If Daenerys had been weak, she would have perished with Viserys. I know she is fierce. Astapor, Yunkai, and Meereen are proof enough of that. She has crossed the grasslands and the red waste, survived assassins and conspiracies and fell sorceries, grieved for a brother and a husband and a son, trod the cities of the slavers to dust beneath her dainty, sandaled feet. Now how do you suppose this queen will react when you turn up with your begging bowl in hand and say, "Good morrow to you, auntie. I am your nephew Aegon, returned from the dead. I've been hiding on a pole boat all my life, but now I've washed the blue dye for my hair, and I'd like a dragon, please. And, did I mention, my claim to the Iron Throne is stronger than your own?"
Aegon's mouth twisted in fury.
"I will not come to my aunt a beggar. I will come to her a kinsman with an army. A small army."
There, that's made him good and angry. The dwarf could not help but think of Joffrey. "I have a gift for angering princes. Queen Daenerys has a large one, and no thanks to you.
Tyrion moved his crossbows.
Say what you want. She will be my bride. Lord Connington will see to it. I trust him as much as if he were my own blood.
Perhaps you should be the fool instead of me.
Trust no one, my prince. Not your chainless maester, not your false father, not the gallant duck, nor the lovely L'Amour, nor these other fine friends who grew you from a bean. Above all, trust not the cheesemonger, nor the spider, nor this little dragon queen you mean to marry. All that mistrust will sour your stomach and keep you awake by night. 'Tis true, but better that than the long sleep that does not end. The dwarf pushed his black dragon across a range of mountains. But what do I know? Your false father is a great lord, and I am just some twisted little monkey man. Still, I do things differently. That got the boy's attention. How differently? If I were you, I would go west instead of east, land in Dorne and raise my banners. The Seven Kingdoms will never be more ripe for conquest than they are right now. A boy king sits the Iron Throne. The North is in chaos. The Riverlands a devastation. A rebel holds Storm's End and Dragonstone. When winter comes, the realm will starve. And who remains to deal with all of this? Who rules the little king? Who rules the Seven Kingdoms? Why, my own sweet sister. There is no one else. My brother Jamie thirsts for battle, not for power. He's run from every chance he's had to rule. My uncle Kevin would make a passably good regent if someone pressed the duty on him, but he will never reach for it. The guard shaped him to be a follower, not a leader.
Well, the guards on my lord father.
Mace Tyrell would grasp the scepter gladly, but mine own kin are not like to step aside and give it to him. And everyone hates Stannis. Who does that leave? Why, only Cersei. Westeros is torn and bleeding, and I do not doubt that even now my sweet sister is binding up the wounds with salt. Cersei is as gentle as King Maegor, as selfless as Aegon the Unworthy, as wise as Mad Ares. She never forgets a slight, real or imagined. She takes caution for cowardice and dissent for defiance. And she is greedy, greedy for power, for honor, for love. Tommen's rule is bolstered by all of the alliances that my lord father built so carefully, but soon enough she will destroy them, every one. Land and raise your banners, and men will flock to your cause, lords great and small folk too. But do not wait too long, my prince. The moment will not last. The tide that lifts you now will soon recede. Be certain you reach Westeros before my sister falls, and someone more competent takes her place.
But, Prince Aegon said, without Daenerys and her dragons, how could we hope to win?
You do not need to win, Tyrion told him. All you need to do is raise your banners, rally your supporters, and hold until Daenerys arrives to join her strength to yours.
You said she might not have me.
Perhaps I overstated. She may take pity on you when you come begging for her hand. The dwarf shrugged. Do you want to wager your throne upon a woman's whim? Go to Westeros, though. Ah, then you are a rebel, not a beggar. Bold, reckless, a true scion of House Targaryen. Walking in the footsteps of Aegon the Conqueror, a dragon. I told you I know our little queen. Let her hear that her brother Rhaegar's murdered son is still alive. That this brave boy has raised the dragon standard of her forebears in Westeros once more.
that he is fighting a desperate war to avenge his father and reclaim the Iron Throne for House Targaryen, hard-pressed on every side. And she will fly to your side as fast as wind and water can carry her. You are the last of her line, and this mother of dragons, this breaker of chains, is above all a rescuer. The girl who drowned the slaver cities in blood, rather than leave strangers to their chains, can scarcely abandon her own brother's son in his hour of peril. And when she reaches Westeros and meets you for the first time, you will meet as equals, man and woman, not queen and supplicant. How can she help but love you then, I ask you? Smiling, he seized his dragon, flew it across the board. I hope your grace will pardon me. Your king is trapped. Death in four. The prince stared at the playing board. My dragon is too far away to save you. You should have moved her to the center of the battle. But you said I lied. Trust no one, and keep your dragon close. Young Griff jerked to his feet and kicked over the board. Saivas pieces flew in all directions, bouncing and rolling across the deck of the Shy Maid. Pick those up, the boy commanded. He may well be a Targaryen after all. If it please your grace. Tyrion got down on his hands and knees and began to crawl about the deck, gathering up pieces. It was close to dusk when Yandri and Issylla returned to the Shy Maid. A porter trotted at their heels, pushing a wheelbarrow heaped high with provisions. Salt and flour, fresh churned butter, slabs of bacon wrapped in linen, sacks of oranges, apples and pears. Yandri had a wine cask on one shoulder, while Ysylla had slung a pike over hers. The fish was as large as Tyrion. When she saw the dwarf standing at the end of the gangplank, Ysylla stopped so suddenly that Yandri blundered into her, and the pike almost slid off her back into the river. Duck helped her rescue it. Ysylla glared at Tyrion and made a peculiar stabbing gesture with three of her fingers. A sign to ward off evil. Let me help you with that fish, he said to Duck. No, Ysylla snapped. Stay away. Touch no food besides the food you eat yourself. The dwarf raised both hands. As you command. Yandri thumped the wine cask down onto the deck. Where's Griff? He demanded of Holden. Asleep. Then rouse him. We have tidings he'd best hear. The queen's name is on every tongue in Solaris. They say she still sits in Meereen, sore beset. If the talk in the markets can be believed, old Valentis will soon join the war against her. Holden pursed his lips. The gossip of fishmongers is not to be relied on. Still, I suppose Griff will want to hear. You know how he is. The half-maester went below. The girl never started for the West. No doubt she had good reasons. Between Meereen and Valentis lay 500 leagues of deserts, mountains, swamps and ruins, plus Mantares with its sinister repute. A city of monsters, they say. But if she marches overland, where else is she to turn for food and water? The sea would be swifter, but if she does not have the ships... By the time Griff appeared on deck, the pike was spitting and sizzling over the brazier, whilst Ysylla hovered over it with a lemon squeezing. The sellsword wore his mail and wolfskin cloak, soft leather gloves, dark woollen breeches. If he was surprised to see Tyrion awake, he gave no sign beyond his customary scowl. He took Yandri back to the tiller, where they spoke in low voices, too quietly for the dwarf to hear. Finally, Griff beckoned to Holden. We need to know the truth of these rumors. Go ashore and learn what you can. Caver will know, if you can find him. Try the Riverman and the Painted Turtle. You know his other places. I'll take the dwarf as well. 4 ears hear more than 2.
And you know how Kaivo is about his Sivas.
As you wish. Be back before the sun comes up. If for any reason you're delayed, make your way to the Golden Company.
Spoken like a lord. Tyrion kept the thought to himself.
Holden donned a hooded cloak, and Tyrion shed his homemade motley for something drab and grey. Griff allowed them each a purse of silver from Illyrio's chest to loosen tongues.
Dusk was giving way to darkness as they made their way along the riverfront. Some of the ships they passed appeared deserted, their gangplanks drawn up. Others crawled with armed men who eyed them with suspicion. Under the town walls, parchment lanterns had been lit above the stalls, throwing pools of coloured light upon the cobbled path. Tyrion watched as Holden's face turned green, then red, then purple. Under the cacophony of foreign tongues, he heard queer music playing from somewhere up ahead, a thin, high fluting accompanied by drums. A dog was barking, too, behind them. And the whores were out. River or sea, a port was a port. And wherever you found sailors, you'd find whores.
Is that what my father meant? Is that where whores go, to the sea?
The whores of Lannisport and King's Landing were free women. Their sisters of Selhoris were slaves, their bondage indicated by the tears tattooed beneath their right eyes.
Old as sin, and twice as ugly, the lot of them.
It was almost enough to put a man off whoring. Tyrion felt their eyes upon them as he waddled by, and heard them whispering to one another and giggling behind their hands. You would think they'd never seen a dwarf before. A squad of Volantine spearmen stood guard at the river gate. Torchlight gleamed off the steel claws that jutted from their gauntlets. Their helms were tiger's masks, the faces beneath marked by green stripes tattooed across both cheeks. The slave soldiers of Valentus were fiercely proud of their tiger stripes, Tyrion knew.
Do they yearn for freedom? He wondered. What would they do if this child queen bestowed it on them? What are they, if not tigers? What am I, if not a lion?
One of the tigers spied the dwarf and said something that made the others laugh. As they reached the gate, he pulled off his clawed gauntlet and the sweaty glove beneath, locked one arm around the dwarf's neck, and roughly rubbed his head. Tyrion was too startled to resist. It was all over in a heartbeat.
Was there some reason for that? He demanded of the half-maester.
He says that it is good luck to rub the head of a dwarf, Holden said, after an exchange with the guard in his own tongue. Tyrion forced himself to smile at the man.
Tell him that it is even better luck to suck on a dwarf's cock.
Best not. Tigers have been known to have sharp teeth. A different guard motioned them through the gate, waving a torch at them impatiently. Holden Halfmaester led the way into Selhoris proper, with Tyrion waddling warily at his heels. A great square opened up before them. Even at this hour, it was crowded and noisy and ablaze with light. Lanterns swung from iron chains above the doors of inns and pleasure houses, but within the gates they were made of coloured glass, not parchment. To their right, a night fire burned outside a temple of red stone. A priest in scarlet robes stood on the temple balcony, haranguing the small crowd that had gathered around the flames. Elsewhere, travellers sat playing Sivas in front of an inn. Drunken soldiers wandered in and out of what was obviously a brothel. A woman beat a mule outside a stable. A two-wheeled cart went rumbling past them, pulled by a white dwarf elephant.
This is another world, thought Tyrion, but not so different from the world I know.
The square was dominated by a white marble statue of a headless man in impossibly ornate armor,
astride a warhorse, similarly arrayed.
"Who might that be?"
wondered Tyrion.
"A Triarch Hirundo, a Valentine hero from the Century of Blood. He was returned as Triarch every year for 40 years, until he wearied of elections and declared himself Triarch for life. The Valentines were not amused. He was put to death soon after, tied between two elephants and torn in half. His statue seems to lack a head. He was a tiger. When the elephants came to power, their followers went on a rampage, knocking the heads from the statues of those they blamed for all the wars and deaths." He shrugged. That was another age. "Come, we'd best hear what that priest is going on about. I swear I heard the name Daenerys." Across the square, they joined the growing throng outside the Red Temple. With the locals towering above him on every hand, the little man found it hard to see much beyond their asses. He could hear most every word the priest was saying, but that was not to say he understood them. "Do you understand what he is saying?" he asked Holden in the common tongue. "I would, if I did not have a dwarf piping my ear." "I do not pipe." Tyrion crossed his arms and looked behind him, studying the faces of the men and women who had stopped to listen. Everywhere he turned, he saw tattoos. "Slaves? 4 of every 5 of them are slaves." "The priest is calling on the Valentines to go to war," the half-maester told him. "But on the side of right, as soldiers of the Lord of Light, R'hllor, who made the sun and stars and fights eternally against the darkness. Nisus and Malachor have turned away from the light," he says, "their hearts darkened by the yellow harpies from the east." He says, "Dragons?" I understood that word. He said, "Dragons." "Aye, the dragons have come to carry her to glory." "Her? Daenerys?" Holden nodded. "Benero has sent forth a word from Volantis. Her coming is the fulfillment of an ancient prophecy. From smoke and salt was she born to make the world anew. She is Azor Ahai, returned, and her triumph over darkness will bring a summer that will never end. Death itself will bend its knee, and all those who die fighting in her cause shall be reborn." "Do I have to be reborn in this same body?" asked Tyrion. The crowd was growing thicker. He could feel them pressing in around them. "Who is Benero?" Holden raised an eyebrow. "High priest of the Red Temple in Volantis. Flame of truth, light of wisdom, first servant of Lord of Light, slave of R'hllor." The only red priest Tyrion had ever known was Thoris of Myr, the portly, genial, wine-stained roisterer who had loitered about Robert's court, swilling the king's finest vintages and setting his sword on fire for Meles. "Give me priests who are fat and corrupt and cynical," he told Holden, "the sort who like to sit on soft satin cushions, nibble sweetmeats and diddle little boys. It's the ones who believe in gods who make the trouble." "It may be that we can use this trouble to our advantage. I know where we may find answers." Holden led them past the headless hero to where a big stone inn fronted on the square. The ridged shell of some immense turtle hung above its door, painted in garish colours. Inside, 100 dim red candles burned like distant stars. The air was fragrant with the smell of roasted meat and spices, and a slave girl with a turtle on one cheek was pouring pale green wine. Holden paused in the doorway. "There, those two." In the alcove, 2 men sat over a carved stone Sivas table, squinting at their pieces by the light of a red candle. One was gaunt and sallow, with thinning black hair and a blade of a nose. The other was wide of shoulder and round of belly, with corkscrew ringlets tumbling past his collar. Neither deigned to look up from their game until Holden drew a chair between them
and said, "My dwarf plays better Sivas than both of you combined." The bigger man raised his eyes to gaze at the intruders in distaste, and said something in the tongue of old Volantis, too fast for Tyrion to hope to follow. The thinner one leaned back in his chair. "Is he for sale?" he asked, in the common tongue of Westeros. "The Triarch's grotesquerie is in need of a Sivas-playing dwarf." "Yellow is no slave." "What a pity." The thin man shifted an onyx elephant. Across the Sivas table, the man behind the alabaster army pursed his lips in disapproval. He moved his heavy horse. "A blunder," said Tyrion. He had as well play his part. "Just so," the thin man said. He answered with his own heavy horse. A flurry of quick moves followed, until finally the thin man smiled and said, "Death, my friend." The big man glowered at the board, then rose and growled something in his own tongue. His opponent laughed. "Come now, the dwarf does not stink as bad as that." He beckoned Tyrion toward the empty chair. "Up with you, little man. Put your silver on the table, and we will see how well you play the game." "Which game?" Tyrion might have asked. He climbed onto the chair. "I play better with a full belly and a cup of wine to hand." The thin man turned obligingly and called for the slave girl to fetch some food and drink. Holden said, "The noble Cavo Nagaris is the customs officer here in Solaris. I've never once defeated him at Sivas." Tyrion understood. "Perhaps I will be more fortunate." He opened his purse and stacked silver coins beside the board, one atop another until finally Cavo smiled. As each of them was setting up his pieces behind the Sivas screen, Holden said, "What news from Don River? Will it be war?" Cavo shrugged. "The Yunkai would have it so. They style themselves the wise masters. Of their wisdom I cannot speak, but they do not lack for cunning. Their envoy came to us with chests of gold and gems and 200 slaves, nubile girls and smooth-skinned boys, trained in the way of the Seven Sires. I am told his feasts are memorable and his bribes lavish." "The Yunkish men have bought your Triarchs?" "Only Nisus." Cavo removed the screen and studied the placement of Tyrion's army. "Malachor may be old and toothless, but he is a tiger still, and Doniphus will not be returned as Triarch. The city thirsts for war." "Why?" wondered Tyrion. "Meereen is long leagues across the sea. How has this sweet child queen offended old Volantis?" "Sweet?" Cavo laughed. "If even half the stories coming back from Slaver's Bay are true, this child is a monster. They say that she is bloodthirsty, that those who speak against her are impaled on spikes to die lingering deaths. They say she is a sorceress who feeds her dragons on the flesh of newborn babes, an oathbreaker who mocks her gods, breaks truces, threatens envoys, and turns on those who have served her loyally. They say her lust cannot be sated, that she mates with men, women, eunuchs, even dogs and children, and woe betide the lover who fails to satisfy her. She gives her body to men to take their souls in thrall." "Oh, good," thought Tyrion. "If she gives her body to me, she is welcome to my soul, small and stunted though it is." "They say," said Holden. "By they, you mean the slavers, the exiles she drove from Astapor and Meereen." "Mere calumnies." "The best calumnies are spiced with truth," suggested Cabo. "But the girl's true sin cannot be denied. This arrogant child has taken it upon herself to smash the slave trade. But that traffic was never confined to Slaver's Bay. It was part of the sea of trade that spanned the world, and the Dragon Queen has clouded the water. Behind the black wall, lords of ancient blood sleep poorly, listening as their kitchen slaves sharpen their long knives. Slaves grow our food, clean our streets,
teach our young. They guard our walls, row our galleys, fight our battles. And now, when they look east, they see this young queen shining from afar, this breaker of chains. The old blood cannot suffer that. Poor men hate her, too. Even the vilest beggar stands higher than a slave. This dragon queen would rob him of that consolation.
Tyrion advanced his spearmen. Kaevo replied with his light horse. Tyrion moved his crossbowmen up a square and said, "The red priest outside seems to think Volantis should fight for the Silver Queen, not against her." "The red priest would be wise to hold their tongues," said Kaevo Nagaris. "Already there has been fighting between their followers and those who worship other gods. Benero's rantings will only serve to bring a savage wrath down upon his head." "What rantings?" the dwarf asked, toying with his rabble. The Volantine waved a hand. "In Volantis, thousands of slaves and freedmen crowd Temple Plaza every night to hear Benero shriek of bleeding stars and a sword of fire that will cleanse the world. He has been preaching that Volantis will surely burn if the Triarchs take up arms against the Silver Queen." "That's a prophecy even I could make. Ah, supper." Supper was a plate of roasted goat served on a bed of sliced onions. The meat was spiced and fragrant, charred outside and red and juicy within. Tyrion plucked at a piece. It was so hot it burned his fingers, but so good he could not help but reach for another chunk. He washed it down with a pale green Volantine liquor, the closest thing he'd had to wine for ages. "Very good," he said, plucking up his dragon. "The most powerful piece in the game," he announced, as he removed one of Kaevo's elephants. "Andaerys Targaryen has three," it said. "Three," Kaevo allowed, "against thrice 3,000 enemies?" Grasdan Moiraz was not the only envoy sent out from the Yellow City. When the Wise Masters move against Meereen, the legions of New Gis will fight beside them, Tulasi, Illyrians, even the Dothraki.
"You have Dothraki outside your own gates," Holden said.
"Carl Pono." Kaevo waved a pale hand in dismissal. "The horse lords come, we give them gifts, the horse lords go." He moved his catapult again, closed his hand around Tyrion's alabaster dragon, removed it from the board. The rest was slaughter, though the dwarf held on another dozen moves. "The time has come for bitter tears," Kaevo said at last, scooping up the pile of silver. "Another game?"
"No need," said Holden. "My dwarf has had his lesson in humility. I think it's best we get back to our boat."
Outside in the square, the night fire was still burning, but the priest was gone, and the crowd was long dispersed. The glow of candles glimmered from the windows of the brothel. From inside came the sound of women's laughter. "The night is still young," said Tyrion. "Kaevo may not have told us everything, and whores hear much and more from the men they service."
"You need a woman so badly, Yellow?"
"A man grows weary of having no lovers but his fingers."
"Solores may be where oars go. Taisha might be in there even now, with tears tattooed upon her cheek."
"I almost drowned. A man needs a woman after that. Besides, I need to make sure my prick hasn't turned to stone." The half-maester laughed.
"I will wait for you in the tavern by the gate. Do not be too long about your business."
"Oh, have no fear on that count. Most women prefer to be done with me as quickly as they can."
The brothel was a modest one, compared to those the dwarf had been wont to frequent in Lannisport and King's Landing. The proprietor did not seem to speak any tongue but that of Volantis, but he understood the clank of silver well enough, and led Tyrion through an archway into a long room that smelled of incense, where four bored slave girls were lounging about in various states of undress. Two had seen at least 40 name days come and go, he guessed. The youngest was perhaps 15 or 16. None was as hideous as the horse he'd seen working the docks, though they fell well short of beauty. One was plainly pregnant. Another was just fat and sported iron rings in both her nipples. All four had tears tattooed beneath one eye. "Do you have a girl who speaks the tongue of Westeros?" asked Tyrion. The proprietor squinted, uncomprehending, so he repeated the question in High Valyrian. This time the man seemed to grasp a word or two and replied in Volantine. "Sunset girl," was all the dwarf could get out of his answer. He took that to mean a girl from the Sunset Kingdoms. There was only one such in the house, and she was not Taisha. She had freckled cheeks and tight red curls upon her head, which gave promise of freckled breasts and red hair between her legs. "She'll do," said Tyrion. "And I'll have a flagon too, red wine with red flesh." The whore was looking at his noseless face, with revulsion in her eyes. "Do I offend you, sweetling? I am an offensive creature, as my father would be glad to tell you, if he were not dead and rutting." Though she did look Westerosi, the girl spoke not a word of the common tongue. "Perhaps she was captured by some slaver as a child." Her bedchamber was small, but there was a mirrorish carpet on the floor and a mattress stuffed with feathers in place of straw. "Oh, I've seen worse." "Will you give me your name?" he asked, as he took a cup of wine from her. "No." The wine was strong and sour and required no translation. "I suppose I shall settle for your cunt." He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "Have you ever bedded a monster before? Now's as good a time as any. Out of your clothes and onto your back, if it please you, or not." She looked at him uncomprehending, until he took the flagon from her hands and lifted her skirts up over her head. After that, she understood what was required of her, though she did not prove the liveliest of partners. Tyrion had been so long without a woman that he spent himself inside her on the third thrust. He rolled off, feeling more ashamed than sated. "This was a mistake. What a wretched creature I've become." "Do you know a woman by the name of Taisha?" he asked, as he watched his seed dribble out of her onto the bed. The whore did not respond. "Do you know where whores go?" She did not answer that one either. Her back was crisscrossed by ridges of scar tissue. "This girl is as good as dead. I've just fucked a corpse. Even her eyes look dead. She does not even have the strength to loathe me." He needed wine, a lot of wine. He seized the flagon with both hands and raised it to his lips. The wine ran red down his throat, down his chin. It dripped from his beard and soaked the feather bed. In the candlelight, it looked as dark as the wine that had poisoned Joffrey. When he was done, he tossed the empty flagon aside and half rolled and half staggered to the floor, groping for a chamber pot. There was none to be found. His stomach heaved, and he found himself on his knees, retching on the carpet, that wonderful thick, mirrorish carpet, as comforting as lies. The whore cried out in distress. "They will blame her for this," he realized, ashamed. "Cut off my head and take it to King's Landing," Tyrion urged her. "My sister will make a lady of you, and no one will ever whip you again." She did not understand that either. So he shoved her legs apart, crawled between them, and took her once more. That much she could comprehend, at least. Afterward, the wine was done, and so was he. So he wadded up the girl's clothing and tossed it at the door. She took the hint and fled, leaving him alone in the darkness, sinking deeper into his feather bed. "I am stinking drunk." He dared not close his eyes for fear of sleep. Beyond the veil of dream, the sorrows were waiting for him. Stone steps ascending endlessly, steep and slick and treacherous, and somewhere at the top the Shrouded Lord. "I do not want to meet the Shrouded Lord," Tyrion fumbled back into his clothes again and groped his way to the stair.
"Griff will flay me. Well, why not? If ever a dwarf deserved a skinning, I'm him."
Halfway down the steps, he lost his footing. Somehow he managed to break his tumble with his hands and turn it into a clumsy, thumping cartwheel. The whores in the room below looked up in astonishment when he landed at the foot of the steps. Tyrion rolled onto his feet and gave them a bow.
"I'm more agile when I'm drunk." He turned to the proprietor. "I fear I ruined your carpet. The girl's not to blame. Let me pay."
He pulled out a fistful of coins and tossed them at the man.
"Imp!" a deep voice said behind him.
In the corner of the room, a man sat in a pool of shadow, with a whore squirming on his lap.
"Oh, I never saw that girl. If I had, I would have taken her upstairs instead of Freckles."
She was younger than the others, slim and pretty, with long silvery hair. Lysenny, at a guess. But the man whose lap she filled was from the Seven Kingdoms, burly and broad-shouldered, 40 if he was a day, and maybe older. Half his head was bald, but coarse stubble covered his cheeks and chin, and hair grew thickly down his arms, sprouting even from his knuckles. Tyrion did not like the look of him. He liked the big black bear in his surcoat even less.
Wool? He's wearing wool. In this heat? Who else but a knight would be so fucking mad?
"How pleasant to hear the common tongue so far from home," he made himself say.
"But I fear you have mistaken me. My name is Hugo Hill. May I buy you a cup of wine, my friend?"
"I'm drunk enough."
The knight shoved his whore aside and got to his feet. His sword belt hung on a peg beside him. He took it down and drew his blade. Steel whispered against leather. The whores were watching avidly, candlelight shining in their eyes. The proprietor had vanished.
"You're mine, Hugo."
Tyrion could no more outrun him than outfight him. Drunk as he was, he could not even hope to outwit him. He spread his hands.
"And what do you mean to do with me?"
"Deliver you," the knight said, "to the queen."